Welcome to Statistical Convergence, the podcast about War Machine, where casual meets hardcore with a side of math. I'm Sung Soo, and represent the hardcore part of the catchphrase, as well as half the math. You can follow us on Facebook at CO Wargaming to keep up to date with our various projects. My co-host Stussy will be joining me after the intro music to talk about Convergence's newest caster, Athanor Locke. Stussy, I know you've been on the Convergence train since it started. In the last 6 months, you've gotten two new releases, so how excited are you for Miss Locke?
On the one hand, I have to say I'm sad. I have a lot of nostalgia for Syntharion as the original Battlebox caster for Convergence, and I think Locke pretty much steals his thunder. They tend to run very similar lists, and outside of some edge cases involving Syntharion's feet, Locke pretty much does everything he does better. On the other hand, I am excited that she opens up lines of play that just didn't exist for Convergence before now. I love casters who do shenanigans, and Locke definitely fits that bill.
She's definitely a weird caster, double-dipping into Convergence and Crucible Guard. She was pre-released at Lock and Load, and by now, we each have a handful of games with her. So one disclaimer I want to make in this episode is there's a lot of theory, with a little bit of gameplay to back it up. If you don't agree with something we say, we'd love to hear about it and why.
As always, we want to start a discussion on a new caster with just running through the card, taking a few minutes to make sure we don't forget anything and that everybody knows what we're talking about. Stat overview for Locke, she's Focus 7, and the front of her card it says Mat 5, Rat 5. As with Orion, there's other things going on, so the front of the card only tells half the story. We'll cover this more in spells, but suffice it to say, Mat 5 is just a starting point. She's Def 14, Arm 17, with 18 boxes.
It's a solid defensive stat line. I feel like we say the same thing every week. That being said, the stat line can definitely become more tanky, but more on that later.
Other than those basics, she's speed 5, she's living, like Axis, and has two melee weapons. Enhanced Fists, they're 1-inch range, power plus strength 12 with crit knockdown.
Again, just like Axis, she doesn't have magic weapons and she's not a construct. That being said, she does have a way to fix that on herself, at least.
And double flamethrowers. Spray 6, POW 12. The flamethrowers are damage type fire, like you'd expect, and cause continuous fire when they hit things. The weapons are not what you're bringing Locke for. She can get some work done herself, but really, she's an enabler for the rest of the army. On the back side of that card are her abilities. Like all other full-time Convergence casters, she has a Field Marshal, in this case, granting Precision Strike to all Warjacks in her battle group. Precision Strike giving Warjacks in this model's battle group the ability, when they make a melee attack, to choose which column or branch takes the damage.
It's really hard to put a value on this. The biggest piece of advice I can give you is just don't forget we have it.
She is also resourceful, much like Syntharion, allowing her to upkeep spells on her battle group for free.
She has a ton of upkeeps to get work out of this, but more on that later.
She also has a star action. She can repair models for D3 plus 3 damage points in base-to-base range. And she has a extra bit of text, which is one that we care deeply about. Split loyalties. When included in a Crucible Guard army, Locke is a Crucible Guard model, not a Convergence model. And when included in a Convergence army, Locke is a Convergence model, not a Crucible Guard model.
Today we're mainly going to be packing her in the Convergence side. At the end, we might tease one or two things about Crucible Guard with her, but again, Stussy and I are Convergence players. We don't have split loyalties.
And her feat, Archodynamic Catalysis. The feat comes in three parts. The first, enemy upkeep spells and animi in Locke's control range immediately expire.
A free purification is nothing trivial. Also, being wired the way I am, it's really the only part of the feat I can count on, but more on that later.
The second point, when an enemy model is forced, casts a spell, or spends one or more focus or fury points while in Locke's control range, you can place one catalytic token on a model in Locke's battle group currently in her control range. If a model casts a spell by spending Focus or Fury, Archodynamic Catalysis triggers only once, so no double dipping there, and a model cannot have more than three catalytic tokens on it at any time. What do those catalytic tokens do? That's part three. A model gains plus one defense and armor for each catalytic token on it. The weapons of a model with one or more catalytic tokens on it gain damage type magical.
It's definitely hard to count on how many of these you'll put down, so that's why I prefer the purification side of the feat. I'm not saying that this is something trivial, I like to count on what I'm going to have for a reprisal turn.
Absolutely. I will say that much like Axis, I feel she's able to play pretty aggressively on the feat turn specifically. Not many things can get to and kill a caster without spending focus or fury, and the second they do, her defensive stats start going from average to bonkers real quickly.
This is kind of what we alluded to before. A 14-17 can very rapidly become a 17-20, in which case she's an extremely tanky warcaster. Feat tokens go down as soon as the focus is spent, so if they boost a hit, your defense actually goes up before that roll is made. If they boost the damage, your arm would actually go up before that damage roll was made as well. This is also the way we're talking about fixing the magic weapon issue. Every model with a feat token becomes damage type magical. It's really the only way that Locke has access to magical weapons herself.
And the last part. You remove one catalytic token from each affected model at the end of that model's activation.
It's very bookkeeperish. We'll see if Muzan Minis or Broken Eggs makes tokens for this. Thinking. The feat in general honestly reminds me of Cryptic Command. I know we both played a little Magic. You start explaining it to the opponent, their eyes kind of gloss over, they ask you really. It just does a lot of things.
Even if you tell them up front, they're not going to remember that it continues over into following turns so that you can be getting the benefit across multiple rounds. So that works our way through most of the card. Sung-Soo, you want to handle the spells?
Yeah, I can give it a whirl. She has quite the spell lift, and we're going to go ahead and start off with Engine of Destruction. It's a cost 2 spell that gives the caster plus 2 speed, plus 4 strength, and plus 4 mat for one turn.
I am pretty sure Privateer Press put this spell on the list explicitly for Convergence players. Our vectors benefit from this. When we said that her stat line mat 5 only tells half the story, this is what we were talking about. Outside of the convergence-specific interactions, the plus 2 speed is pretty meaningful in terms of extending threat ranges with Locke's flamethrowers. Going to mat 9 is really the most important thing about it.
Yep, the only side note I'll have is honestly with her being able to threat that far and playing pretty far up the table with that defensive stat line of potentially 17-20, she can definitely get some work done herself and bully the table. Next up, we have Jackhammer, cost 1, 6-inch range. Target model in the caster's battle group immediately makes one basic melee attack.
This spell with Convergence's vectors is pretty powerful, and it also enables one of her coolest tricks and is the reason you really want to consider bringing an Arc Node with her.
Next up is Redline, cost 2, range 6, upkeep. Target Warjack in the spellcaster's battle group gains plus 2 speed and plus 2 strength. And you can run, charge, make slam, or trample attacks without spending focus. At the end of each of its activations, the affected Warjack suffers D3 damage points.
This spell is extremely strong. Don't get trapped into the thought that you always need Engine of Destruction going for the mat 9. Being able to activate a Jack first, spend the focus, and then activate Locke opens up the possibility of rolling Redline to benefit from it twice in the same turn. Also, don't forget the damage on the Jack. It's really easy to miss because you're concentrated on doing things with that Redline Jack and then moving on to the rest of your turn after you've done your focus induction, but this damage really matters if the game drags on.
It absolutely does, and that's a great reminder. Road to War is next. It's a cost 3 range self upkeep spell. When a friendly faction model in the caster's control range destroys one or more enemy models with a melee or ranged attack during its activation, immediately after the attack is resolved, one warjack in the caster's battle group that is in its control range can immediately advance up to 3 inches. A warjack can only advance as a result of Road to War once per turn.
This is an incredible movement ability for your battle group with a ton of flexibility. A quick brainstorm of applications for this movement. You could get another jack into induction range after you've charged way up the field. Have a jack that has already gone clear charge lane for a follow-up. Get your corollary into a better position to pick up focus at the end of the turn. Reposition a shooting jack behind terrain after it's gone. Just plain extend threat ranges. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out the slight weakness here, which is that if you kill a model using Jackhammer, that doesn't trigger Road to War.
It really is a bonkers spell, and I know we'll talk more about it later. She certainly has a lot of upkeeps, as we said, to benefit from that resourceful. And next up is Sentry. Cost 2, range 6, upkeep. Friendly faction model gains Rapid Fire. Rapid Fire. This model can make one basic range attack during your maintenance phase.
Here's our combined arms spell. It's hit and miss on many of the guns in Convergence because the threat ranges are so predictable, but a Cypher can almost always be finding something productive to be doing, if nothing else.
Lastly, we have Bombshell. Cost 3, range 10, 3-inch AoE, POW 13. On a critical hit, models hit are thrown d6 inches directly away from the attacker. Roll distance once for all models affected. Models thrown do not deviate. Move models farthest from the attacker first. Instead of suffering blast damage, models hit suffer a POW 10 damage roll. The POW of the collateral of any is also POW 10.
It's cute, but that's sure a lot of text getting spent on a crit I'm never counting on getting.
Okay, so we covered Locke's cards. There's a lot there. Stussy, what are some of the tips and tricks we alluded to earlier that you've uncovered so far?
Well, I'm going to just start with the headline act. Here's how I see it going down. Top of three, your lines are jammed by all sorts of crud. You upkeep redline on your inverter that you held a little ways back. Angry conservators start going to work cleaning out infantry, opening up a pocket. You get a 3-inch move from road to war triggering, and then your pet inverter powers up and slams on the gas, thunders 12 inches down the field, using the long chain on the meteor hammer to reach between two blocking models. Your opponent's eyes go wide as an arc node huffs and puffs to keep up, barely getting within 6 inches. Activate lock. Cast Engine of Destruction, and I've got 5 jackhammers to go. Narrative flair aside, I'm pretty sure this is how everyone's first or second assessment of Locke went. 17 inches of non-linear, non-line-of-sight threat is pretty legit, even if you end up unable to boost your to-hit rolls.
If a caster can be threatened by Mat 9, Power and Strength 17, you should definitely take note of it. Another thing to be mindful of is that Arknode does have to huff and puff to keep up, so while the threat of this might be farther than the Arknode's range, the Arknode really only has a 10-inch run and a 6-inch arc for that jackhammer. For me, one of the tricks with Locke was just unpacking. Turn 1 can be a bit weird. She wants to spend all of her focus, Sentry, Redline, Road to War. So when setting up, make sure that the Corollary can get a focus from activating X to Locke, run to allocate it, make sure that focus can go through your line, back to the other side of the line, and end up back on the Corollary. Keep this in mind or you'll often find yourself going into Turn 2 either with an empty Corollary or missing an upkeep.
And this is something that definitely happened to me, plus leaving random diffusers hanging out behind my lines because I forgot that they were there because I'm not used to playing with the medium jacks. Even while not focusing on assassination specifically, Road to War and Redline are an extraordinarily potent combination that can bring the threat of all of our heavy vectors up to 13 to 14 inches with melee. Being able to have that kind of control radiating out from any heavy vector is big, and while they may not be super cheap, they are affordable enough that you can trade vectors away if the opportunity arises to scalpel out key pieces of the enemy army. So what does all of this mean for the army lists that we're building? I can't honestly imagine running Locke without at least one or two of the dedicated melee heavies. While the inverter's native 2-inch reach is always nice and its built-in knockdown lets it operate well in the absence of Engine of Destruction, I've really warmed up to the conservator of a lot with Locke. Going to effective Mat 11 if you can get Hand of Vengeance up puts a ton of threat on high defense warcasters without needing to boost a hit, which matters a lot with Jackhammer, and all of that for a 12-point package. While the melee jacks are really efficient point-wise, triggering Road to War can be tricky without access to ranged attacks. Sentry might not be an astounding spell, but it's a decent one, and it'd be nice to take advantage of it.
The other thing I think is worth mentioning is she has basically zero control elements to her, permissive or hard control. A Cypher with the free 4-inch rough terrain or flare each turn via Sentry is rock solid, versus non-Pathfinder armies, 3 4-inch templates of rough terrain is huge, and I'm never going to sneeze at a free 4-inch flare.
Absolutely, and it's worth saying the Cypher is also one of our best beat sticks in the army. It may not be all the way up or the first one you reach for when you start trading pieces, but it does clean up duty like a champ. The Diffuser is also in an odd spot, with Locke's heavy vectors already threatening so far. The possibility of tacking an extra 2 inches onto that 13 to 14 inch threat range is super tempting, but actually engineering that happening on the board is harder than it looks simply because the ranges are so long. That said, a Rat 5 Lucky Gun is an okay tool for getting that Road to War trigger. I'm never disappointed by having a diffuser in, but I won't turn down the chance to upgrade it to a modulator either.
Yeah, one of the things you said I thought was interesting is you have your diffusers in the back line. I try to make sure that all of my medium-based jacks are always in the front, even if it's a ranged jack. I kind of want them out there. Again, she doesn't have a control element. I'd rather they end up charging and take the alpha on my diffuser than on any of my heavy hitters. That being said, the Assimilator toes a really interesting line. A really nice range gun for triggering Road to War and a solid melee attack. While a little more expensive, I think they're definitely worth trying. Trying them so far, I've really enjoyed it. We can use Road to War as a poor man's Repo 3 if nothing else, and like I said, the Ground Pounder opens up some avenues she otherwise wouldn't have access to.
And Ground Pounder's ability to ignore huge amounts of defensive tech is really nice for triggering Road to War, even against armies that have some protection against shooting. So far, when talking about Locke's kit, we've been covering pretty much all offense all the time. She does have one piece of defensive tech on her card, which is her feet. But it's a hard one to evaluate. It is a wall of text. TT, how's your experience with it been?
It started off pretty mediocre, and mainly that's like just crushed dreams. You always imagine these turns where you end up with like 18 feat tokens, and that really just never happens. I think the most I've ever pulled down is like 9 or maybe 10 in a game. But honestly, most of the time, I'm really tempering my expectations, and I'm planning on getting 4 to 5. Obviously, you should be able to look at the board state and evaluate that. One of the things I mentioned earlier is I like to be able to count on things. I like to be able to know that things are going to happen. And for that reason, I've been trying just to leverage the quote-unquote purification aspect of the feat more than I'm going to factor on the a couple models are going to get a defensive and an arm buff. The last thing I'll say about that is a death bonus doesn't really make that much of a difference with where we fall on the standard bell curve with our Jack's defensive line until we get 2 or 3 tokens on them. So if you don't think you're going to get a ton of tokens, it might not be worthwhile to put it on the vector. You might just want to stick it on lock so you do have that flexibility to play her a little bit further forward. What about you, Stussy?
I have to agree. I actually had one game where I got 0 feat tokens out of it. The odd experience I had with this was that when I'm playing my heavy vector lists, the sort of pieces that go hunting heavy vectors are usually pretty efficient about it and are able to get the job done in 2, 3, 4 hits, something on that order of magnitude. If they're spending focus or fury in order to do this, you're not going to get a lot of benefit out of putting the tokens onto the piece that is getting hit. So it really benefited me to shift my mindset to trying to identify whatever they were going to hit next and start loading it up so that they wouldn't be able to just chain through the army. I will give them one vector and I want to try and stop them at 2. If they can go into that next vector and have it already be at def 13 or 14, that's a really big change. Also, as you said, because the feat can persist between turns, lock is by far the piece best able to make use of a small number of feat tokens. So if there's any doubt in your mind about where you should be putting it, lock is a safe bet and will allow you to play her more aggressively forward later into the game. One of the big questions for me initially when looking at lock is if she wants to play with a colossal. It can't benefit from Road to War, even though it can trigger it, and the extra strength from Redline may easily be wasted. That said, it wears the feat tokens better than anything else in the army other than lock because of its huge depth of damage boxes as well as already high armor. I got at least a few games in with it, and it certainly wasn't bad. It jackhammered like a boss, but it felt like I was giving up some of the special sauce that makes lock work in favor of putting a big solid piece of good stuff on the table.
The other issue I had with lock and Axiom is she doesn't help the Axiom do anything he wasn't already doing. If the Axiom gets something into melee, most of the time it's killing it. The jackhammer is certainly nice for ensuring it finishes it off, but it isn't mandatory, and if you want that Axiom activating at mat 9, it means the jackhammer is not going to be there. The same things that cause the Axiom issues in normal matches, say an Axiom Lucant list, are going to cause it issues with an Axiom lock list.
Also, sustained attack is only during the Axiom's activation.
That's an excellent point to bring up, Stussy.
So, before we get into the nitty-gritty of lists, I had a question for you that kind of relates to this versatile kit that Locke brings to the table. I ran into this spot in my first game with Locke versus Vyros 2. I've rumbled up on turn 1, put red line on an inverter in the middle of my lines. He goes, and Locke the targets my red line jack, preventing it from charging. Imperatus runs up on a hill on one flank, threatening to wreck my face. I decide that his lone heavy jack is the primary threat to my army, and that Mr. Redline can still walk into melee if I get the Road to War trigger. I get the movement with an assimilator shot into some infiltrators, and then activate lock, put up Engine of Destruction, and send the inverter in. What I learned is that Imperatus is way harder to kill than your average jack. I do a mess of damage, but then find out that Phoenix Protocol is a really good ability. I finagle another charge into him with a flanking modulator that got a bit of work done with the only focus I could put on him, but it wasn't enough to stop the character Myrmidon from standing up and wrecking my face the following turn. While I did go on to win that game, I felt I really botched that play somehow and should have been able to close the deal. Since I bet you're not going to be surprised by Imperatus's durability, how would you have approached the situation?
So first, let me start by saying how amusing it is to now discover that you're finding out rules by face checking them. Way back in the day when we first met, you were that guy in the meta, and now you're basically learning rules with your face. So, Imperatus Ippy, for the rest of this conversation, has a proposed buff in CID and a point reduction coming his way. So it's definitely something we should count on seeing and is important to understand. When you disable Ippy for the first time, it's going to come back with all of its shield in one box in each system, which works out to be 17 boxes, on top of the 34 he already starts with. That's an impressive 51 boxes, and honestly, it starts to rival colossal ranges here. With a defensive stat line of 13-18, I understand why you wanted Engine of Destruction out there first, but I think we could do better. A loaded inverter walking in with at mat 9, 3 focus, and redline is only about 91% chance to disable Imperatus, and that's before we factor in Phoenix Protocol. So clearly one inverter with redline isn't going to drop Ippy. We're just under 92% chance to hit with the knockdown. If we do, we have an expected damage of 43, and a standard deviation, which we taught you how to calculate in episode 2, of plus minus 5.4. However, the odds of us triggering Phoenix Protocol on the last swing is basically a coin flip, and even if we win that coin flip, one swing can't drop all the boxes he gets back. If we miss the initial knockdown, our expected damage drops to 29.5 with that same previously mentioned deviation.
Check. So that lines up with my experience. Even in the best case scenario of redline and engine going, so an inverter has to get really lucky just to do enough raw boxes to finish the job itself, never mind overkill caused by Phoenix Protocol.
Right, and a better solution in this instance is to send the inverter in at mat 5 and boost it to hit with the knockdown. We're going to be just under 83% chance to hit. If we hit, we have an expected damage of 34 with a standard deviation of plus minus 4.8. If we miss, our expected damage goes way down and is much closer to 10. Now, I said the solution was better, and the reason being is Locke herself. In the best case here, Ippy just procced Phoenix Protocol, but is on the ground, and two jackhammers would finish him off nicely.
And if I remember that board state, this was the only melee going on that turn. So I'm just spending the focus on jackhammers that I would have been spending on Engine of Destruction, and I'm still left with plenty to camp.
That being said, and from playing poker for a long time, you ultimately need to know when to fold hands as well. If we didn't hit with the knockdown, we Engine of Destruction, and we basically have a 92% chance to hit with an expected damage of 8, plus or minus 2.5 for a deviation. We already determined we can expect a damage output of around 10, plus or minus that same 2.5, if we missed with the knockdown. That's the damage the inverter would do if I missed with the knockdown, but I went ahead and boosted the hit and boosted the damage with the second swing. I think the easiest way to do this is to look at each individual attack and figured when Ippy would end up triggering Phoenix Protocol. We have 24 boxes to go, and each jackhammer doing 8 makes this pretty easy. It takes 3 jackhammers to trigger the Phoenix Protocol, at which state we would have committed 5 focus, 2 for Engine of Destruction, 1 for each of those jackhammers. However, if we're being cautious, we need to assume it was going to take 4. At that stage, Ippy's going to proc Phoenix Protocol, come back with 17 boxes, and that's way more than we can even dream of one jackhammer delivering. Even in the best case scenario, we're pretty close to a coin flip to drop that hollowed Myrmidon. But the ability to throw these attack on after the fact greatly increases the odds of one jack plus lock killing Imperatus. Remember too, the precision strike is there, targeting the movement when you get through the shield to bump up those hitting numbers even more. That being said, if you miss with the knockdown Imperatus with the inverter, I don't even think you should try cleaning up the job. However, that's clearly the best chance we have on doing it. Okay, with all that in mind, Stussy, what have you been putting in Locke's army and why?
So I've been testing mostly vector spam. As a first draft for the army list I wanted to work with, I started with 2 inverters and a conservator as the melee package. I then added a modulator and an assimilator for triggering Road to War, and a cipher for general utility and melee threat. I put in a diffuser for beacon and the Road to War trigger because I kind of wanted to try it out and I had the points left over. Added the support staff, a corollary, an OptiFex directive, and 2 arc nodes, and then Servitors to Taste from Destruction Initiative. And I want to note that because of Locke's base mat and rat 5, I lean heavier on the Attunement Servitors here than I do with other casters. The list inherits the bevy of heavy vectors from Syntharion, who is one of the casters I have a lot of games with, eschewing the Axiom to get more triggers and benefits from Road to War. I definitely want the multiplicity of premier melee vectors, the conservator and the inverter, with the nod to the cipher, to give a variety of angles to attack from. All the shooting options can generate multiple attack rolls to try and get an initial key Road to War trigger, which is one of the key things I like about the list.
We definitely have similar initial thoughts for the list. My one thing is, how do you actually end up going about it if you have to receive the charge?
Because of Locke's long threat ranges, I'm typically not planning on receiving the charge, and I will happily trade away a vector in order to just start the peace trade on my turn. If I have to take it, It's going to be put something out front as a sacrificial lamb, and then cluster everything else, let's say 3 to 4 inches behind it to try and counterpunch.
And how do you feel those perform so far?
Well, assassination possibilities of Locke are legit. Even without jackhammer shenanigans, having to respect a 14-inch reach around multiple different vectors isn't easy. And with the number of heavy vectors you're fielding, you can afford to hand one away as part of a particularly good piece trade if the opportunity presents itself. I've caught players with this who are much better than me and knew that this was coming and still died. While I haven't played into it yet, I think the list probably has a weakness exactly where you'd expect it to be. Anything that's good against Jack Spam, as Locke isn't bringing defensive tech beyond her feet to the table, and the feat's value is highly matchup dependent. Since Slayer Spam, Virus 2, and Karchev, at least locally, are still seeing play, there are plenty of people with incentive to bring those kind of lists. So Sungsu, what are you putting on the table?
Well, this is kind of hard. As I said before, we're both in the same mindset, and I've tried a lot of variations, and this is ultimately not the one I love, but it's the one I like the most so far. It's Locke Indestruction Initiative. It's 2 assimilators, a cipher, for the same reasons you mentioned, right? That cipher is my defensive tech piece and our hardest hitting jack. A corollary, a diffuser, 5 galvanizers, an inverter, servitors to taste, and I always take an OptiFex directive.
Them galvanizers. Most of the rest of the package seems in the same line as what I was thinking about, but I'm really interested in how that many light vectors plays on the table.
So first, I own 17, and they're all painted, so I just need to get them on the table. Second, she has no control element. None. I need something to receive that charge. That's why I asked you that question beforehand. They can go out in front, they're threatening enough that they have to be dealt with, and moreover, they're going to take the charge, and that's ultimately where we end up setting the battle line. While I admit that Locke can slingshot jacks really far out there, we're not benefiting from induction at that stage, and I feel like we don't trade our jacks very well. We're paying the point cost for induction. If we're not using it, I think we're going to lose out. Lastly, I'll mention, and I hate crit fishing, the galvanizers do have crit grievous, and crit grievous and precision strike is very cute, bordering on cool. But versus a lot of the meta out there, I really just felt like I needed something to get out in front of my list and catch the oncoming long threat ranges that are coming towards me.
How do you feel the list has performed in the games you've been able to get?
It's done okay. There's only one game where I've really felt great about her. She wins more into matchups I think Convergence already wins. I really wish she didn't cover the same airspace as Axis. That being said, there are some great matchups for her. I actually really like her into the Gatsby 3 Slayer matchups if your goal is to kill the Slayers. I also think medium-based spam she's pretty solid into. Warpath allows you to get a little deeper so your vectors don't peter out after just killing 2 things. She's also a phenomenal answer with Jackhammer into some of the more stubborn battle engines. I, like you, tested the Axiom, and I'm not saying it's bad, but I more think she just really wants to leverage Road to War more. The things that flummoxes the Axiom still give its headaches with Locke. All in all, she lets it smash things harder, but it already did that. Lastly, I can't help but notice that neither of us put a TEP on the table. It feels like we bring this up for every caster, but it's hard to ignore one of the most efficient, caster-independent attacking pieces we have available in the faction.
I'm conflicted, honestly. On the one hand, we've talked about how the TEP really wants protection from the caster, and Locke doesn't give it any of that. On the other hand, it's probably the most reliable tool we have for getting initial Road to War triggers, and to hear some people talk about it, it's capable of single-handedly scaring off Weapon Master swarms that would otherwise be problematic for the Jack-heavy lists. Also, once again, we've both put down Destruction Initiative lists. Clockwork Legions does exist, and does Locke have any home there?
I mean, why would you want to? Destruction Initiative is so good that the caster needs to offer something pretty specific and pretty compelling to make Clockwork Legions look enticing.
And how do you feel about the algorithmic dispersion OptiFex with Locke?
I've never called it that. I've always just called it an ADO. Given the threat representation by the running Jackhammer assassinations, I think you're silly not to take one. Even if you're not going for that Jackhammer assassination, the ability to jackhammer across the board or farther away from Locke is extremely beneficial.
Yeah, and I also want to say that since I've been I've really liked running her with 2 because many of her buffs are extremely short range, and when I'm running 6 heavies, they tend to fan out pretty far. So being able to always have a arc node standing behind the lines in order to put red line onto a new jack is really nice.
The one thing I'll say following up to that is if you happen to be playing into lock, you should try to scalpel out the ADOs as quick as possible. If they're trying to leverage the really long jackhammer threat, it means the ADO is going to be somewhat near the front line as he's only going to be speed 5. While he isn't normally a high target priority in convergence, in this specific matchup, I think it's a very important piece to scalpel out.
So we've talked about what we want to bring with lock, what we want to play with. What does lock not enjoy playing against?
I'm going to start with the obvious, and normally this is true whenever you're running a Jack-heavy list, but P-Scar, or moreover, Weapon Master spam is really awkward for her. She doesn't have a great way to kill swaths of infantry, and they hit really hard. We normally end up with a disadvantageous piece change in this instance. Next up is Purification. It's weird, but it is on casters. Two of the new Crucible Guard casters have it, Silvestro and Locke herself. In addition, we have the normal Menoth bringing of it. Kruger 2 Bones has proved awkward. The number of TKs and weird control elements they can throw out there. In the typical Bones list, they don't have a ton of easy road to war triggers, so if they play a little cagey on that, TK ends up being a lot of control with this. And then basically, I kind of alluded to this earlier, but armies that don't give up easy road to wars can often cause us issues. We're counting on that road to war. Whenever we talk about theory machine on this, we're always assuming we're able to get those extra 3 inches, but there are some matchups where we really have to work for that. So Stussy, how do you feel about Locke and where she fits in our faction?
I feel about her pretty similar to how I feel about Orion, honestly. She's powerful. She's new, and she opens up an aggressive style of melee-focused heavy vector play that I don't think we really had access to before. I worry about how much game she has into matchups where the opponent is fully aware of the tricks she can pull, which I haven't been able to get yet because she only just came out. Because she is so dependent upon exactly delivering heavy jacks to melee range, I put her just below the upper echelon of warcasters in the game, which honestly isn't a bad place to be. She has a strong game plan built in, has the tools to enable it against a fair bit of the hate out there, but she's not infallible.
Absolutely, and with that in mind, I have similar struggles. I'll start by saying she's a good, well-thought-out caster. She has clear synergies and fits within the context of the Destruction Initiative theme extremely well. That being said, she occupies so much of the same airspace as Axis. I don't really see her fitting into my tournament pair because of this. She does cover some bases as better than Axis. I mentioned it before, but if your goal is to kill the Gaspy Three Slayers, she does a better job of it. That being said, she loses a lot of the scenario and counterplay that Countercharge and Bulldoze brings into it. She drops those stubborn 120mm bases much better than any of our other casters, but is that enough for her to deserve a slot in a Steamroller pair? For me, she's a welcome addition to the Convergence lineup, but she doesn't displace Axis, and because of that, I don't think she's going to be in my normal rotation unless Champions tells me she has to be. All of that being said, I do think that Locke has a home in Crucible Guard. This is all theory machine, but Crucible Guard has some interesting tools that Convergence doesn't. The first one I'm going to talk about is the Toro, which is a fantastically pointed jack that has countercharge on it innately. So it gives us some of the tricks and shenanigans Axis has, but with all that wonderful upkeep and threat extension that Locke has. They do have access to power up, and not being dependent on induction makes me way more willing to slingshot a jack pretty far out there. The Suppressor is also a phenomenal jack, with those two spray eights and the ability to do some debuffing on them, whether a defensive debuff or an arm debuff, to just pile on the ability of the Toro to really get work done. We're talking about the initial power of the Toro, which is a respectable 18. We're combining a Rust from the Suppressor and a red line to get up to that 22 range, which is a phenomenal place to be. We couple that in with the Road to War and all the other shenanigans we mentioned, plus a jackhammer, and she really threatens it out there. The last thing I'll say Crucible Guard really has for her that she loves is going to be the Liberator. It's a basic Lancer-esque arc node, with the big thing is it can always arc when engaged in melee. So her ability to jackhammer or get her buffs wherever she needs to go and be able to do that for the duration of the game is much higher in Crucible Guard than it happens to be in Convergence.
I spent a little bit of time at least just scanning through the cards to see if I were playing Crucible Guard, what would I be playing? And I think that Locke has a lot less assassination potential in Crucible Guard than she does in Convergence because they aren't able to leverage Engine of Destruction to pump all the Warjacks up to Mat 9. That said, they've got some really interesting pieces to bring to the table that I think would work differently. If I were looking to build this, I would definitely want to be leaning heavily on the Vindicator. At 15 points, it is a very compellingly priced jack with a potent gun. Shooting attack is going to give it the ability to really trigger Road to War whenever, wherever you want. and it has a respectable melee capability as well. I'd be looking to use the Vindicator particularly for the 3-inch Road to War movement. Then it can aim, go up to range 16, and put really terrifying shots downfield.
Absolutely, and Crucible Guard is not hurting for great targets for Sentry. Sentry doesn't have to be a battle group spell, so there's a ton of models in Crucible Guard that benefit from it. I won't take the time to go into all of them, but the Battle Engine is a phenomenal one. The Vulcan is also a great piece for it, and either of the aforementioned Heavy Jacks we mentioned, both don't sneeze at it.
Okay, TT, so after talking last episode so much about the Clockwork Angels, I know you've been putting some quality time in with them. Have you had a change of heart?
I mean, I still hate them, but I understand why you've kind of liked them. I've been playing a unit or two, once even three, and the ability to get something fast up the field is beneficial, even if it's just scalping out solos or contesting pieces that otherwise I'd be really slow moving to. Since obstructors and reductors and every other weird math terminology for infantry models is basically speed 5. What I hate about them, though, is normally it comes down to me doing one CRA, and then they repo away and they hope they don't die. That being said, I've come around a little bit on them, and I think one unit might have a permanent place in the weird Lucant list I've been testing.
On the flip side, I got in one game without them, and since I've managed to acquire some more infantry since the recording of our last episode, I think there'll be a bit less of an automatic inclusion in my armies, unless the caster in question is offering something specific to them. Okay, now, we've had a couple of conversations recently, some on air, some off, and I feel like there's been a repeated pattern of how do we feel about this caster, and the answer I hear you saying a lot is, yeah, they're good, but they're not Axis. So my challenge to you would be, take some local tournament and try building a list pair that doesn't use Axis.
Yeah, I can certainly give that a whirl. What are you going to be giving up for this quote-unquote convergence lint?
Well, right now, Orion is probably my go-to, and giving up the caster who I have the most recent repetition with, and honestly probably putting Axis in the pair instead, just to get games with him, would be my offering.
No, that sounds more than fair, and I encourage everyone that's listening at home that maybe it is a good time to go ahead and shelf that crutch or that handicap stick you've been leaning on and try other things in the game. If nothing else, it'll make you a better player, it'll confirm your suspicions about other casters, and it'll get you some additional reps. So that ends our review of the newest Convergence caster, Locke, and with it, episodes 3 of Statistical Convergence. Stussy, how do you think we did?
I think we did great, and I gotta say, I am super pleased that we actually got a compelling new Warcaster out of somebody else's release.
Well, more than Stussy's opinion, we'd love yours. Be sure to follow us at Facebook at CO Wargaming and leave any feedback, good, bad, or otherwise. You can also follow me on Twitter at SungSu, TSEUNGTSU. Well, this episode was about Convergence. We're happy to talk about any topics you'd like us to shed some light on, so please don't be shy and let us know what you'd like to hear. I know Stussy and I are both excited for our next episode. We'll be focusing on Father Lucant, the Divinity Architect, and diving a little deeper into Clockwork Legions. Before we go, I'd like to thank Muson Minis for hosting us, Bleep Blop Buzz over on Instagram for our great intro music, and everyone else who's helped us along the way. Till next time, keep calculating those odds. All right, mate. I know you've been playing Convergence for a while. How excited are you about our new caster, Athanor Locke?
Why, mate? I'm quite excited. A bit weepy for old Cynthia put out to pasture, but Locke herself is right peachy.
We'll go with that. It's going to sound horrible. I've got nothing else.
Let us never speak of this again.